Hello, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. I'm Madeline Taylor, your host for the next half hour. I'm going to be airing an interview for you. If you've been listening in around this time the last couple weeks, you'll know that we have been airing our documentary series that we've been producing since last September over the last 4 weeks. It's called this UBC 100 Doc Series, and there are all these historical documentaries produced using tapes from our archives that we digitized. They were on reel-to-reel tapes, cassettes, and some CDs, and now they are all available for you through the UBC Library in their archives. You can listen and download. There's some really cool stuff there. We also play excerpts from the archives on a show called Pete's Picks, which airs today, so Thursdays at 11 a.m., there's Peter pointing at me from the other room. It's really fun. You should tune in. There's some super weird stuff in there. But this documentary that is going to air today was produced by Eleanor Waring, one of our CITR heroes. She's a wonderful person. And it's called Waiting for Godiva, Conversations about Sexism at UBC 1980 to 2013. And she juxtaposes two different events at UBC to talk about sexism and the development of the conversation around rape culture at the institution. It's a fantastic documentary. It's going to air at 4 p.m. And we will have podcasts of that documentary up for you tomorrow, Friday, February 5th. So right now, I have an interview for you that I did with Eleanor 2 weeks ago, where we talk about the process of producing the documentary, some of the questions that I had for her after listening to it for the first time. So you'll get a little bit of context, you'll get a little bit of the history of her interest in the topic, and a preview about the documentary. So this is an interview with Eleanor Waring, and be sure to tune in again at 4 p.m. to hear the documentary itself, Waiting for Godiva, Conversations about Sexism at UBC 1980 to 2013. And just a little trigger warning, in case listeners are sensitive to topics about sexual assault or violence against women, you may want to tune out for the next half hour, because that is a large part of what we will be talking about. I'm Madeline Taylor, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded ancestral territories of the Musqueam people here at the University of British Columbia. And I am sitting with Eleanor Waring. Eleanor, hey.
Hey.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Eleanor. I'm in my fifth year at UBC studying human geography, in my third year at CITR, double majoring CITR in geography, and I am one of the producers of one of CITR's radio documentaries.
We started this series back in September, and it's CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. So we're looking at the history of UBC through a very specific lens, which is CITR's archival tapes, our reel-to-reels, which have been digitized. Can you give us a 20-second rundown of your doc?
Totally. So my documentary looks at the history of rape culture and conversations about sexism, sexual violence at UBC from about 1980 to the present day. So the first half of the documentary looks at something that the engineers used to do called the Lady Godiva Ride, and that it looks at a period from about 1979 to 86. And then the second half of the documentary focuses on the controversy surrounding the Sauder School of Business, Frosch, in 2013, where there were chants used that promoted non-consensual underage sex. So I kind of use those two events to see in the past 30 years what has changed when these things come up.
Why did you decide to make this pitch?
Well, I spent this past summer working at the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, the AMS SASC, and it really opened my eyes to the issue of sexualized violence and rape culture on campus in a way that I previously hadn't thought about it. And just, yeah, like looking at the way that university campuses are a host to so many like problematic things. And so that was kind of in the forefront of my mind. And I've also always kind of had this issue with people, and I talk about this a little bit in the documentary, but people who have this idea that, well, it's just university, you know, what happens here is not really, you know, it's like not the real world yet. And we're not, students aren't out. And once they get all their stupidness out, you know, they'll go out into the real world. But that is just so not true, right? Like, this is, I mean, even before university, but it's such an important time for people to get a sense of, like, what's acceptable and what's okay and what you should be aware of and what you should be, like, standing up against. And the fact that there's such a dominant rape culture that exists on campuses that a lot of people seem to not care about scares me, because I just think about all the people that partake in that and then go out, are going to leave university and go out into the world. And I just think it's something that people need to be more aware of. So there's that piece. And then I looked through the archives that had been digitized already, and I found some of the pieces on Lady Godiva from the 80s. And in particular, a couple of them were the women from the Women's Center in the 80s talking about this. You can just hear in their voices this frustration that I know still exists now because I've seen it, but I don't know if it exists in the same way. And it was really compelling to me, so I wanted to dive more into it.
Well, and I'm guessing that that frustration is something that you could relate to yourself, having worked at the SASC all summer long.
Yeah, and just even coming up against that, those attitudes, like apathetic attitudes on campus, and also being one of those students. Like, I'm not, one of the things that I felt a lot when I was working on the documentary is, like, I care a lot about this stuff now, but certainly throughout my time at UBC, I haven't been, like, a front lines activist at all. And that, you know, that's interesting to me because I think that's an experience for a lot of students. So, yeah.
The experience of not being on the front lines talking about these issues.
Yeah, like kind of being aware of them and being like, oh, yeah, I don't think that that's good that that happens, but what am I going to do about it? You know, I'm not exempt from that. And I think it's just interesting to me.
Well, for people who haven't listened to the documentary yet and who weren't at UBC or involved in an engineering department elsewhere in Canada or anywhere else up until the 1980s, what were the Lady Godiva rides?
So the engineers have a patron saint of engineering who is Lady Godiva, and I got mixed reports on where this story came from, but that's kind of neither here nor there, in my opinion. Basically, during engineering week every year in the 70s and 80s, the engineers would have this big parade where all of the engineers would march through campus, and they would have all these, like, things they had stolen and stunts they had pulled off, and they kind of hyped everybody up. And one of the centerpieces of that parade was Lady Godiva, who is a woman who rides naked on a horse. And it comes from the legend of Lady Godiva, which is a really old story about a woman who rides through a town naked on a horse to make her evil husband stop taxing the town. Not really sure where the connection came to engineering, but so that's what the Lady Godiva ride was. And by the time it was like the early to mid 80s, a lot of other students on campus were up in arms against it, because they felt it was this overt show of sexism and kind of this attitude that women's bodies were just this object to be kind of consumed by everybody else and not respected.
Mm-hmm. And how does that connect to the controversy around Sauter Frosch in 2013?
So the Sauter Frosch thing, I think it's interesting because I started to see this real similarity between the Lady Godiva ride as part of this larger parade and this school spirit bonding type event, and kind of this show of, like, look who we are, we're the engineers. The woman who rode the horse, it was totally voluntary, like, or they paid her, so it's not like they were forcing anybody, to my knowledge, to get up on the horse and do that. And so I came across this argument that was kind of like, yeah, you know, it was, we looking back, we shouldn't have done that, but at the same time, it was kind of just all in good fun. And then when you look at the Sauter thing that happened at Frosch is this orientation, this group event that kind of is aimed at making solder students, business students, bond with each other and get into the solder spirit of things and kind of make friends. And it happens right at the beginning of the year. And then the chants that were happening were, again, kind of like, you know, it's not the same as the Lady Godiva ride. Obviously, there's a lot of differences, but I also just see a lot of similarities in that. It was kind of this thing that everyone was like, well, you know, it's not that harmful. Like, it, the words are not good, but it's just a chant, you know? It's just something that we're doing, and no one's really paying attention. And it was just kind of wound up in this entire entity of frosh that was so about belonging and being part of this group, this kind of mob mentality thing. And from what I understand of the Lady Godiva ride, it was part of this big parade mob mentality thing of the engineers. And I think in both cases, you don't have explicit physical acts of violence, like you don't have somebody assaulting somebody else, but you see how these kind of like the words or promotional type attitudes are reflecting, I think, the same disregard towards sexism and sexual violence.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And I want to bring up one thing that I noticed when I first listened to the documentary, which was the solder school chants are pretty widely understood and known to be called the solder school rape chants. Mm-hmm. They happened in 2013, and that's what the media came to call them pretty quickly as a bit of a buzzword.
Yeah.
And they came up against similar chants that were happening across Canada in other universities around frosh and introductory events. And I wanted to ask you about why you have not referred to them as the solder school rape chants.
Yeah, so one of the things that I was aware of in both studying the Lady Godiva ride and the solder chants is that the national media covered both of these stories, so media outside of UBC and UBC media covered it as well. But you see a lot more of the sensationalizing in the national media's coverage, which, of course, I mean, it's the news. They want to get hooks. They want people to kind of pay attention to what they're saying, and I understand that. But I think in some ways I wanted to avoid, you know, consistently saying the rape chants, because I felt like when I was on campus at that, because I was in third year when the chants happened, it added to the sensationalization of the event rather than, you know, because it feels scandalous to say, well, UBC's rape chants, right? And what is that doing? Like, is that getting us to really talk about the issue that's at hand here? Not often, I don't think.
Well, and it didn't really result in many conversations that were productive around changing the culture that resulted in those chants.
Yeah.
And something that you do talk a little bit about in the doc is how the administration reacted to the chants and the actions they took to, quote-unquote, remedy the situation. And I noticed that those are similar to what happened with the Lady Godiva ride. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah.
Looking at the administration's response?
Yeah, totally. So there's a lot of improvements that have been made over the last 30 years, which is good in terms of how the administration responds to incidents like this. So there was a lot more of a formal stance taken with the solder chants than there was with Lady Godiva. In the 80s, the university officially opposed. They came out and said, like, we are against this. But there was no actions taken, from what I understand. Nothing severe enough to really ultimately end the ride. I think it was, from my understanding anyways, it was the engineering students who kind of said, this doesn't seem to be very popular anymore because of the protests that other students were doing, and because I think the faculty were kind of saying, maybe you shouldn't do this anymore. But it seems to me that it was ultimately the students that ended it. And when you look to 2013, when the solder chants happened, the university took a lot more of a strong stance. And they made public statements, and the solder administration had the leaders of the frosh go through training with the SASC, and they really...
What kind of training?
Like anti-violence ally training, how to respond to disclosures of sexual assault, kind of why, you know, a chant about non-consensual sex is not okay. I mean, things like that, I would assume. And so in a lot of ways, their response was improved. But there's also things that are still very major that are missing. And these are the concrete follow-up actions. And it just kind of makes you wonder, you know, it's great that we have these formal stances and that we have, you know, the president of the university and the dean of engineering saying, this is not in the spirit of UBC and this goes against our values and everything. But, you know, how much does that make people go, oh, okay, well, they're dealing with it, and not actually look and say, well, like, UBC still doesn't have a formal sexual assault policy. And no, that's not going to solve everything, but it's a formal recognition that, yes, there is this issue exists on this campus. You know, that still doesn't. So when the concrete actions don't exactly line up with this formal stance that's being made, you know, that worries me, because people go, well, look, like, they're against it. You know, they oppose it. They have this formal position and they know it's a problem. And it's like, that's all fine. But, like, if the rates of sexual assault are the same or higher than they were 5 years ago, then
Yeah.
Right?
Well, there's this interesting parallel that you make between the Lady Godiva ride and what ended up happening at the end of the 80s in Montreal with the École Polytechnique massacre. Mm-hmm. And then you make a similar parallel between the stranger sexual assaults that followed the Sauder School rape chants in the fall of 2013, the fall and winter of 2013. And it seems to me that you're making a similar comparison between the attitude that university is a place to experiment and that this isn't the real world and we don't have to worry so much about what people do here because they're just dumb kids and like and the broader spectrum of what is dangerous about rape culture in the real world. So can you talk about how you constructed that set of comparisons?
Yeah, so this didn't really become apparent to me until I was like knee-deep in working on this, but I find it really interesting how you have this attitude in engineering in the 80s where, you know, like 10% of the faculty of UBC engineers were women, and so it's mostly men, and Engineering Week is very kind of boisterous and masculine and showy masculinity, I guess, maybe. That's a weird word to use. But anyways, and that was kind of, there was very few women in engineering at that time. And then at the end of the 80s, you have somebody coming onto a campus in Montreal and murdering 14 women because they are in the Faculty of Engineering. And this person wasn't a student. I think he previously had been somewhere else for a year and didn't get into École Polytechnique, actually. And so he was, to generalize, he was from wider society. And he came and killed these women because they were engineers and because he hated feminists. And that was a really big wake-up call for people in the faculty and just, I think, on university campuses in general. And then you look at 2013 on this campus and you have the chants that happened in September. And then as the month went on, we had these reports to the RCMP that became public in the media of these stranger sexual assaults, which is like a man coming out of the bushes quite literally and trying to attack and attacking women across campus. And I think there were like four that happened between September and October. And based on the descriptions the RCMP got, they didn't think these men were students, that their descriptions didn't appear to be. And they never caught that person. But again, if they're kind of from wider society, they're outside of the campus, they're very much a product of this rape culture that, and there you see how that rape culture goes beyond just the university campuses, and it's kind of like we live in it every day. And it's scary because, yeah, it's a complete bridge between, like, universities are not this little bubble that's detached, and there are very real relationships that happen between society outside of university. It's weird to separate them at all, but it's eerie almost to me, the comparison over that 30-year period of something like that happening.
Well, it just speaks to the seriousness of what we mean when we talk about rape culture. Mm-hmm. That it's not something to be taken lightly and theorized about in a classroom, that it has very real-world consequences for mostly women's bodies.
Yeah.
And experiences of safety.
And also that I think some people tried to isolate, and you see this still now, when the shooting happened in Montreal and when the stranger sexual assault happened here, people will say, well, it's different. It's just one crazy guy, one madman, like, or one, you know, messed up person doing this, instead of being like, no, this person is a product of the culture that they live in, and that doesn't obviously make it okay what they did, but it's not just like we're going to just pin this off to one crazy, like, loony that just happened to, unfortunately, do this. It's like, no, they're totally part of the same system. I think that's also important to remember.
Yeah. The bad apple argument is super prevalent and bunk. So
yeah.
I think that was, to me, one of the biggest takeaways from listening to your documentary, is just calling out that ideology,
mm-hmm.
And really pointing to the ways that this is present all the time and that it really needs to be dealt with, especially in academic institutions that are apparently enlightened places of higher learning that are supposedly progressive.
Mm-hmm.
On that note, while you were working on this documentary, you started in September, and it is now January of 2016. good job, first of all. And second of all, in November, there were a number of different things that came down at UBC, and in the broader conversation around sexual assault on university campuses. First of all, The Hunting Ground started to get a lot of play. It's a documentary about rates of sexual assault, mostly in the United States, and the institutional response to sexual assault. But in November at UBC, a story broke about a string of sexual assaults that were handled extremely poorly by the administration, and a few women from the history department at UBC, who are survivors of sexual assault, took their case to the BC Supreme Court to sue the university for negligence, essentially. And this all came down while you were in the middle of working on this documentary, and you don't end up touching on it at the end, which was a decision that I know you grappled with a lot, so I'm wondering if you can talk about it.
It was frustrating because it was really compelling to watch all of that stuff unfold when I was literally dealing with, like, the questions that I was posing while I was making the documentary were literally the same ones that I felt like I was asking when I was watching some of this stuff happen, right? These women were suing the school because things, like, their reports weren't handled effectively. And the argument that I've seen some people make is that if there had been more formal protocol and policies in place, would this have happened in this way, right? And so it fit in so well. But at the same time, something that Lucia Lorenzi pointed out to me when I interviewed her was that this thing is still unfolding. And, you know, as much as there's a lot...
And for context, who is Lucia Lorenzi?
Oh, sorry. She is a PhD student. I think she just defended her master's thesis here at UBC. She's in the Faculty of English, but she's been a really prominent voice about sexual violence and rape culture on campus in the last 4 to 5 years. And she's been here for like 6 years. I think she did her undergrad here, so she really has this broad perspective of the university, I think, more than a lot of other students who maybe aren't here for as long. But yeah, so she pointed out that this thing is still unfolding, and so as much as there's definitely conversations to be had about it and debates to be had and points to be made, you kind of want to wait to see, before you make these conclusions, you want to wait to see where it ends up. And so I wanted to comment on it, but at the same time, stuff was changing, like, week to week. And I also felt like I had already included so much in this documentary that I was maybe going to overload people with information. And also, my original question was kind of to see, you know, have things changed in the last 30 years? So I feel like hopefully some of the arguments I made about, you know, looking back but then looking forward and kind of trying to compare these things will apply when we look at what's happening now and kind of when we ask, is the university administration taking this seriously? Are students taking this seriously? I mean, I don't answer those questions about this unfolding event because there's just too much, but you totally can ask those, and I think really great conversations can come out of just being aware of those issues.
Definitely. Well, Is there anything you want to add here before we sign off?
Yes. One of the other things that I wanted to say about not using the term rape chance was, first of all, that rape actually has no legal meaning in the Canadian court of Canadian law. So it's actually sexual assault, which recognizes that penetrative rape is not the only way that people can be sexually assaulted. So I think by using the word rape all the time, it kind of continues to drive that message that that's the only type of assault that is means anything, which we just know is so not true, right? Like assault, there's a whole spectrum of violence in terms of sexual assault, and it's important to acknowledge that. And the other thing was that I wanted to avoid sensationalizing these stories in a way, because I want people to care about these issues without having them packaged to them in this 30-second news clip, most scandalous report way possible, right? And I know that that's hard, and that's a hard battle that I may be fighting, and I'm obviously not the only one, but I think we are trained to want this kind of every story that happens to just come at us in this most fascinating way. But when you're dealing with sexual violence and sexual assault, that's just so inappropriate. And we need to feel like this stuff matters, not just because it's being presented as, oh my God, there was a rape chant at UBC and can you believe it? No, we need to care about this no matter what, even if it's presented in this more holistic, well-rounded way where it's not black and white and there's so much gray area. And so I wanted to approach it like that, just as an act of defiance against the sensationalized story, which is really hard because I also want people to be interested, but it's a fine line.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that the 24-hour news cycle does not do very well all the time, which is paying attention to nuance. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things about your documentary that was the most compelling, is the amount of detail and care that you took with the topic, especially because when you're talking about sexual assault in any form, there is a temptation to make the trauma sexy again in a weird way and to make it clear who the villains are. Mm-hmm. And obviously, perpetrators of sexual assault are not doing things that are acceptable in any way, but at the same time, their position as an assailant, I don't think can only be chalked up to one evil person.
Exactly.
So I think it's just so important to interrogate the culture that creates enough men, mostly men, to perpetrate violence on 1 in 3 women in our society. Mm-hmm. That's not a case of bad apples, and I thought that that was really what you were trying to get at.
Well, yeah. So you look at that with the chance, and then it's the same with the engineers. Like, a naked woman on a horse, you know, that's a naked woman's body. It has the meaning that you give it. In some contexts, people use nudity as a really empowering thing, which I think is great, but you can't just look at the Lady Godiva ride all on its own, because it didn't exist in a bubble. It existed in a male-dominated faculty in a place where women were not encouraged generally to join in. And then in a place where somebody walked into a school of engineers and killed women just because he didn't think that they should be there, right? Like, you can't just separate those things. And I think that that's really important. You need to look at the whole picture. And that...
All right, thanks for listening. That was an interview that I did with Eleanor Waring, one of our documentary producers for the CITR UBC 100 doc series. Her documentary is called Waiting for Godiva, Conversations about Sexism at UBC 1980 to 2013. Her doc will air today. That's February 4th at 4 p.m. So you can tune in then to listen live, or it will be on our website as a podcast, available very soon after the air date, by tomorrow at the latest. And you can find more information at citr.ca/CITR documentaries. So thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Taylor, and we've got some music for you until the next show comes on air at 2 p.m.